ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the UI Breakfast Podcast. I'm your host, Jane Portman, and today our special guest is Adrian Zumbrunner, a designer and engineer who currently works for Google Lens and Google Assistant. And we're going to talk about meaningful motion in UI design. This episode is brought to you by Balsamiq. A Balsamiq customer recently called it the only wireframing tool that doesn't make me feel stupid. Try the new web app, free for 30 days at balsamiq.cloud. You'll be productive in no time. Hi, Adrian.
Hey, Jane. Nice to meet you.
Totally the same here. We are absolutely thrilled to have you as a guest.
Thanks for having me.
So, we're going to start with a short blitz questionnaire so that we can learn about you personally before starting with the main topic. How does that sound?
That sounds great. Sure.
Question number one is, what do you do for a living?
So I work as a designer at Google, mostly in Zurich, but also in Mountain View quite a lot. And I spend most of my time working on the Google Assistant and Google Lens, which is basically a visual search product to get information about things, about the world, about the things around you.
That is a whole separate, huge topic for discussion. We should have talked about that too. How did you get there? You have a huge history of various online achievements, various talks, articles, whatever not.
Yeah, so actually it's interesting. So I was contracting for Google for about 2 years. So I was working on Google Maps before. And then in early 2016, I turned my website into a chatbot. And then that basically led to some of the people on the assistant team then reached out, and in Zurich, actually. And they asked me if I was interested to join and work with the assistant team. So that's kind of how I started working on the projects that I work on today.
What kind of background education did you have before that? What was your design story?
So I studied business information technology, actually, which is mostly, I think it's the ideal thing to study if you don't really know what to do. because I knew that I didn't really quite know at the time what I wanted to do. So I thought that IT, like computer science itself, is just too much math and stuff. So I figured, but on the other hand, I did want to do something that has to do with computers. And so eventually I ended up picking something that I thought was kind of like in the middle. So it ended up combining business administration with computer science. So I have a bit of a background in both fields. Yeah, but design, I never studied design, actually.
It's a common story. Me neither.
Yeah, it's a common story.
And I'm sure
right?
We're not alone. What does your typical day look like?
So my typical day starts with coffee, actually. So I have a nice old Italian espresso machine, and I'm very obsessed with coffee. And once I have had a coffee at home, I spend way too much time having coffee, also around the office. And I do hope no one at work is listening to this, by the way. And then I usually start, I either talk to people and see what the progress is from yesterday's work. Usually we discuss what the next things are that we want to work on, or we review some of the things that have been implemented in actual code. And then based on that, we discuss the next thing. So sometimes we do that on a daily basis. Often it's on a weekly basis. And yeah, I think my days are not as structured as I make them sound right now, to be honest.
Could you give us a bit of insight what exactly you do with those products you're working on, sort of state of the industry?
What do you mean specifically in terms of like how those products evolve, like their position in the market, or?
I work in the ecosystem of, you know, business-focused web applications, very boring, nothing innovative, and I really don't know much about Google Lens, for example. So we would, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners are like that.
Okay.
So we'd like to hear, you know, brief history of like maybe what I'm currently working on.
Right. Okay. So I can't really talk about what I'm currently working on specifically, but I can give you a bit of background what the project is about, or what some of its goals are, what its promises for
that would be fantastic
for the users.
Yes.
So one of the things we showed at I/O in May this last year was think about you wanting to see a movie, right? And you're at a bus stop and you see that movie poster of Star Wars. Using Lens, you could then point your camera at that movie poster and find, like, maybe you could play a trailer. It would then, the assistant would then talk to you. Oh, looks like a good movie, if it is. And then it would tell you what you want to do. And then it could take actions based on that context, and you could then do things like play trailer, or you could book tickets or find a cinema close to you that would potentially play that, have that movie, right? So that's kind of like the things, and there's a lot of different use cases that can be solved using visual recognition technology, but that's just one example that that comes to mind right now. Other examples are obviously around translation. If you're in another country and you want to translate the menu, that's where Lens can definitely be helpful as well.
Are there any active audiences using it already for some professional needs?
Not necessarily for professional needs, because it's more an end user facing product. So, but we did launch on the Pixel cameras. And so far feedback's been great. We definitely still have a long way to go because the technology is still relatively young. But I think it's very promising, the idea of augmenting people's lives and their surroundings with some of the things that Google has to offer.
Absolutely, because we're already doing all of that, just not in the most convenient way.
Yeah, exactly.
What do you enjoy the most and the least about your work?
I think what I enjoy the most is the people I work with. I think I'm really working with some, I feel like very fortunate to be working with some of the most talented people I've ever worked with. It's just fascinating, the vast amount of like talent that you're surrounded with, from promotion designers to great visual designers, to illustrators, to people who can program things that would take me weeks and literally 2 days. So that's been, I think, one of the things I enjoy the most. For the things that I like less is, so the coffee in Zurich is really not the best. unlike in the Mountain View office, where it's actually pretty good. And I guess another thing is just the thing that you would probably hear from most people working at big companies, which is the political aspect of it. You know, when you design something for yourself. So when I created that conversational website, or when I created the UX Bear, for instance, that were all things that was done within weeks, and sometimes it's just, you're just amazed by how fast you can be when you're doing things alone, right? But then I always remember that quote that if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. And that's kind of the way it feels at Google sometimes. So there are, it obviously can suck sometimes, because you feel like, why is this taking so long? You know, why do we need to have all those discussions? But then on the other hand, you're just reaching such a wide range, like a huge audience, right? There are so many people that come, that get in touch, that use the products that you're working on, that I feel like it really does make up for it.
That sounds like a good trade-off to be made.
Yeah, that's what I tell myself before I fall asleep.
What is your next big thing, I guess personally, since you're not allowed to talk about Google's next big thing?
Yeah, right now I'm... So I think right now it's mostly about writing. I want to spend more time writing again. It's something that I've always been passionate about, but I have a love-hate relationship with writing. Simply, first of all, I'm not a native English speaker, so for me it's pretty hard for me to writing is a painful process, but at the same time it's just so rewarding because you get a much deeper understanding of your ideas, of your thoughts, even design problems. And so yeah, it's definitely something that I want to spend more time working on, as well as being more focused. I feel like today it's harder than ever to be focused. It's something that we probably all have in common, and for me it's particularly hard because I have ADHD, so I get distracted very easily. Mm-hmm. So I have to be careful to really manage my attention as if it was a resource, basically a limited resource.
It is for all of us, but yeah. I imagine we have so many channels these days, and Slack, email, just being primary ones, but like Twitter, Instagram, whatever, not.
yeah, exactly.
So let's go back to our main topic. Mm-hmm. You've been writing about motion in UI for a while. Mm-hmm. One of your most popular articles, oh no, most popular, but early, was it early? Goes back to 2013 in Smashing Magazine. You were already writing about motion design. So then mm-hmm. you called it transitions, smart transitions. And these days, you talk about meaningful motion, which kind of implies some evolution of your thinking.
Yeah, that's correct.
Tell us about that.
Mm-hmm. So I think smart transitions are, I feel like everything that moves, it's more than just transitions. I feel like the my thoughts on the subject are broader in range than they used to be. Now I also think a lot about spatial perception, on how important it is to create interfaces that are spatially built in a way that would be meaningful in the real world as well. And I'm just generally very interested by borrowing principles from the real world and applying them on the mobile space or on the digital canvas without turning it into a skeuomorphic nightmare-like Apple calendar with the letter texture. But just like, just like generally, how can we learn from the real world and apply those learnings to motion design, I think is very interesting.
As a UI designer, I have to confess, I am really not that advanced with the motion component. I'm kind of always hoping that someone down the road is going to take care of that part. So, and I'm sure there are a lot of people in the audience like that. If they want to get started, you know, to be more thoughtful with motion, what kind of basic principles should they start with, should they know about?
So usually what motion designers learn, motion designers, they usually have a background with the 12 Walt Disney animation principles. and those principles, I think they do a good job in creating movies or in creating like just kind of moving images. But when it comes to interface design more specifically, I feel like the most important part is asking yourself what story you want to tell, because everything that moves is a story. For instance, there's interesting research that goes back till the 60s that show how different geometrical shapes are basically moving on the screen. And there's this rectangle and a triangle that kind of like bounce into each other from time to time. But it's actually all random movement. But when participants were asked what they were seeing, they didn't see random movement. They saw a story. They said, that triangle is kind of an asshole. Why does he keep pushing the rectangle? You know, why doesn't it just leave it alone? And so I find that fascinating, but simply by adding movement, we can convey a story no matter what. So that's really at the core of everything I do when it comes to emotion, is really what's the story I'm trying to tell? That's kind of at the core, I would say.
So that would define what exactly we'll be focusing on, and also on the character of the movement itself, which is a whole other story, right?
Yeah, precisely. So that's where actually the Walt Disney animation principles can be useful, right? If you think about exaggeration of movement or a bounce effect, you know, when things like kind of when movement is exaggerated, similar to how things move in nature, but just more to make a point, to add more character to an animation. That also tells you something about the brand, right? How is that a playful brand? Am I interacting with a playful application here, or is it more serious? And that's something interesting as well, right? So in many ways, I feel like you could think of motion like body language. It's very subtle, but it still conveys so much in how an interface looks and feels like.
So we're definitely going to link to the Disney animation principles in the show notes. Do you have any other, you know, go-to resources for people to read up and get started with?
I think so. Understanding the 12 Walt Disney animation principles is certainly a good start. The other thing is definitely reading Spatial Interfaces by Pascal De Silva. It's a great article that at the time I was writing about spatial models, and it turns out that we had very similar thoughts about that. And he basically talks about that same idea of borrowing principles from the real world, you know, thinking about how does a panel slide in? Where does it come in? Where does it live? Because a lot of interfaces we see today, they are built around the idea, almost like a magic trick where something just suddenly comes out of nowhere. I feel like rather than recommending a bunch of articles, because seriously, you can just Google motion design and user interfaces or something, and you will find tons of great articles. But if you were to read one article, I would recommend the article from Pascal De Silva. And another great piece he had on the subject was Transitional Interfaces, which also dates back to 2014 or something. Not sure. But these two articles are a must read. I feel like I met Pascal in New York a year ago, and I think he has so much to say. So many great things to say about motion as well.
Thank you definitely. Thank you for sharing that. What are the tools by means of which we can, as designers who don't code, maybe, we can kind of capture our ideas and understanding and give instructions to people down the road who will be implementing our mockups?
Right. So I feel like there's always a cost that comes with fidelity, right? So the more precise you are in your work, the longer it takes, but it doesn't necessarily do a better job in validating your ideas. So one of the things we do quite a lot at Google is we take Sketch and then we create artboards. Basically, we create artboards next to each other, similar to a comic. And then we add intermediate states and add motion blur to those mockups. And it turns out that the eye and the brain is surprisingly good at perceiving movement, even though there is technically no movement at all. But by just hitting the arrow key and having those intermediary frames that have motion blurred applied to the mock itself, creates the illusion of movement. And so when you show that to people, you can quickly convey, hey, this is how the animation should look like. This is how the animation should feel like. But then you can basically give this to a motion designer who can then actually animate it, or you can give it to coders who can then actually turn that idea into code. So that's, I feel like, it's the most efficient way to draw animations without having to dive too deep into all the tools that are available to actually
that
animate
is a
things.
Great piece of advice. I would never come up with that. So then you export those frames and show them one by one in your presentation tool of choice.
Yeah.
And the person gets the idea how it interacts.
Exactly.
Amazing.
Sometimes you can also turn those individual frames into a GIF, and so then it just keeps playing, and it you will be surprised. It almost looks like a janky GIF from the 90s, but it does do a really good job in conveying what you want to say.
You mentioned there is a special person, a motion designer, who will take care of that. And let's say there is a typical team which consists of a designer and a front-end developer.
Mm-hmm.
Is that going to be front-end developer who takes up that role?
Yeah, I would say yes. I feel like a lot of front-end engineers have started to take note of the importance of animation, and also the technology and cross-browser standards are much better than they used to be. A lot of good animation libraries like Anime.js are really making it way easier than it ever, like much easier than it ever was to create great animations on the web as well. But yeah, I think front-end engineer would definitely be the person who would be working on that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So we are working with different kinds of formats. Can be a mobile application, can be a web application. And of course, it's my impression that mobile apps are much more sophisticated when it comes to various, you know, aspects of motion design, and spatial interfaces, as you call them. Your opinion on that? What can we do to make web apps simple by nature, more interactive?
Yeah, I think there's still this idea that the web is bad in terms of animation, but the web really caught up. I feel like that's an excuse we're sometimes telling ourselves, but the web has gone a long way. Has come a long way in terms of the things you can do with it, and I feel like today it's easier than ever to actually also have fluid animations on the web if you're deliberate about which properties you're animating so that it uses hardware acceleration. So yeah, I feel like what we do have to do is spending time on it. You know, like motion design takes time, and I feel like from a product excellence point of view, motion is actually a profound statement in how your team thinks about product design. Because if your team allocates resources to adding animation to the interface, it really says, we care about what we do. We don't just care about the functionality, but also about the visceral and more experiential layer of the things we put in this world. So that's why I think you need almost like a motion budget for people working on websites, if that makes sense.
Let's say, for example, if we talk about a web app, if it's polished enough, if the execution in the details is great, that, you know, communicates the quality of the entire product. But what you're saying is that with motion design, it takes it to like the next spaceship level of unreachable quality for the product. And that's all in our perception.
Yeah,
right?
That's the spaceship. That's the spaceship level literally taking off. No, I feel like that's a good way to think about it. I would add that ideally your team already thinks as motion, not just as a progressive enhancement of the experience, but as a fundamental part of it. Because sometimes thinking about motion early on also affects your information architectural decisions, how you think about where to put things. Because one of the things I found useful and remarkable about motion design is that by asking yourself, how would I go from that state to that state? Simply asking yourself that question actually often helps you to get a better idea of how you want to structure the things in your design, if that makes sense.
Yes, one of your key takeaways from your Smashing Mag article was that nothing happens instantly. Everything needs a transition, essentially.
Yeah, and I remember someone said, "I don't agree with that," and then I said, "What can I do?" You know. It's just so, like, I feel like one of the obsessions of especially engineers. I like all of them, by the way, is that everything needs to be fast. Faster is always better. But that's a fundamentally flawed thought, I think, because sometimes things do take longer, because research, for instance, shows that when you have to wait a bit longer for coffee, that people perceive the quality of the coffee to be better than it actually is. And the same goes for cash. That it's a very famous example, the cash counting machines, right? When the machine counts too fast, people have not faith in the outcome, in the counting accuracy of the machine, right? So sometimes things that have a value should take longer. Deliberately.
That is a great point.
Yeah. Thanks.
And another example that comes to mind is car manufacturers who have the opportunity to make everything super light and super fast. In larger vehicles, they would often, you know, slow down the acceleration at some points, make the steering wheel heavier so that the owner of the vehicle feels like they're driving a big, strong vehicle.
Right. That's interesting. I didn't know that. That's a great point. That's a great example.
So let's imagine a bootstrapped SaaS business who already have a product which is doing pretty well, and they have now more resources to invest into visual polish and motion design. What can they do to improve their app? Because it would have been amazing to do it from day one, but usually progressive enhancement, that's how it works.
Right.
What would be your advice for such a business? What can they do?
I think one of the good places to start is key interactions. So let's say, let's take an email client as an example, right? In an email client, one of the fundamental interactions is sending an email, hitting the send button. Sending an email is something that gives you a sense of accomplishment. Even that's probably an illusion, but it does give you a sense of accomplishment. So how can you build on top of that emotion? How can you support that emotion and make the emotion basically more felt? So one way to do this is to support that emotion by animating the button in a delightful way, or something that supports what you want to convey, whether it's an email app or no matter what your app is about. But really thinking about critical states and trying to understand how can we make those states more meaningful. Yeah, I think that's one way I would start. Obviously, you can always add, you know, like fade effects and stuff. But I feel like sometimes that's a flawed approach, because that just adds animation for the sake of animation. But you really want to ask yourself, what are the critical pieces that we can enhance with motion? Where should we begin, right? That's I think, a way that I would, that's where I would start. Asking yourself,
That's a great approach to do that. For example, one principle I always advocate for is to focus the entire UI over a few everyday critical features, just like you said, mm-hmm. and adding extra effort to make that smooth and animated well and meaningfully is probably the best investment, right?
Yeah, couldn't agree more. Absolutely.
I know it's probably hard to discuss that over audio, but maybe you have your favorite kinds of animations that really could enhance any app.
My favorite animation that cannot necessarily enhance your app, but that is my favorite animation, is the animation in WhatsApp when you send the voice message. It's very old, actually, but that makes it even more remarkable. So when you send a voice message in WhatsApp, it's the microphone starts recording, and there's a subtle slide to cancel text, basically, that also kind of like has that subtle Apple-like slide to unlock gleam to it. Mm-hmm. And if you then swipe, the microphone jumps up and lands in a trash bin on the other side of the screen. It's absolutely amazing. And that's one of my favorite examples because it's an animation that isn't just functional, but that tells you a story at the same time. And it's a very memorable story that really helps you understand how the interface works. But at the same time, it's fast enough so that you don't feel like it's slowing you down.
Great story. I remember when iPads and iPhones came up with their amazing touch screens. When you delete something, that would jump to the trash bin.
Yeah.
It was so amazing.
So good. So good. Yeah, I've actually met Don Lindsay at UX Salon in Israel. Don Lindsay was the senior vice president of design at Apple back in the days when they were working on OS X Aqua, the fundamentally redesigned OS version from Apple, right? And so he was working on the genie effect. You know how when you reduce, when you minimize a window, how it basically goes into the bar at the bottom with this weird movement?
Yes.
And he told me how engineers almost wanted to kill him for that. I think it's just remarkable that this animation happened in 2001. You know, which is hard to believe if you think about it.
My next question, probably one of the last ones, might be political, so you might as well not answer if you don't want to.
Okay.
But what do you think? So it's going to be about Apple and Google.
Okay.
What do you think? Both have been really mature, have really matured over years, and there is amazing material design in Google, and Apple has been doing some great things. How would you like generally describe Google's approach to design, and particularly motion design, and Apple's approach?
Interesting. I think iOS, Apple's design language, is much more about depth. They have dedicated hardware chips in their phones and in the iPads that can calculate those blurs so that all the animations are smooth. Whereas the analogy of that Google uses is paper. The whole material design language is based on the idea of paper and overlays, but it's not necessarily as much about depth as it is in iOS. So I would say that these are the two most critical ways at the core of how those UI systems are different from one another. And this also affects the way motion works on both platforms.
I think that's exactly what I wanted to hear. All of us know that, but you just verbalized it in the most concise way. Thank you.
Hopefully.
generally speaking, what do you think of, everybody sort of arrived at the same clean implementation, clean, flat, not so flat, design aesthetic,
yeah.
Modern. Do you still feel like there is a kind of design competition going on, or do you think we're kind of arrived at some point of maturity?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think design, similar to fashion, is probably never finished. I think the fact that we see design trends coming up, like brutalism websites that are fundamentally neglecting a lot of the design laws that people spent years learning, is a strong indicator that we have not arrived and that we will probably never arrive. I feel like what we have right now is ultimately a very content-centric model that everything we do is around content, and that's a good thing for the user. But is it the best thing in terms of brand expressiveness, right? Or does it mean that the content itself becomes the expression of the brand? So that's, I think, is an interesting topic. But I don't think that we have arrived, and I don't think that we'll ever arrive, because whenever people get too accustomed to something, we always crave something that's new, something that's different and yet familiar. And that's precisely the reason why I think that a homogeneous design world where everything looks the same will not necessarily be the most satisfying world for the users, even though it would technically, from a pure user experience point of view, from a pure usability point of view, it would make a lot of sense. But I don't think it would be very satisfying.
It's almost as impossible as, you know, utopia in politics. Kind of everybody knows what it should look like, but not exactly, and it's definitely not achievable.
Yeah, it's a good way to see it.
Adrian, thank you so much for joining us today. Your insights were amazing.
Thank you for having me.
I usually end off with some, you know, asking for advice, but this time I decided to ask for advice in the beginning so that we have available stuff coming up early in the episode.
Okay.
Where can people find your awesome work online, your amazing chatbot site, which impressed me deeply?
It's on my website, azumbrunnen.me, but it's probably easier to just search online. Adrian Zumbrunnen is probably easier because it's so hard to spell my name. Start with Z, U, and then hopefully it will find me. I also wanted to ask you a question, though,
yeah,
if you don't mind. What's your goal? What's your goal this year?
My goal is definitely launching and growing a new product that we started with co-founders in the end of last year.
Okay.
So that's very simple. It's called UserList.io. Mm-hmm. And it's a platform for SaaS founders to send relevant messages to their users post-sign-up. But thank you for asking.
Okay, post-sign-up. Okay, no, I have to check it out. Can you say the name again?
Definitely. It's userlist.io.
Okay.
And I will include the link in the show notes.
Cool. That's great. Thanks for sharing.
Thank you. Well, generally speaking, my goal, like globally, is to free up time from consulting towards products, which has been, you know, kind of a trending goal over years.
Uh-huh.
And you seem to be enjoying solving very complex, global product problems, right? The global scale with great teams.
Yeah, I like to think so. Yes, I guess.
Well, thank you so much for joining us again, and I hope you have a great day, Adrian.
Thank you so much. Same to you, and thanks again for having me.
If you enjoyed listening to this episode, please leave a review on iTunes. It will help other people discover this podcast.